Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Imagine, if you can, a small room, hexagonal in shape, like the cell of a bee. It is lighted neither by window nor by lamp, yet it is filled with a soft radiance. There are no apertures for ventilation, yet the air is fresh. There are no musical instruments, and yet, at the moment that my meditation opens, this room is throbbing with melodious sounds. An armchair is in the center. By its side, a reading desk. That is all the furniture. And in the armchair, there sits a swaddled lump of flesh. A woman, about 5 feet high, with a face as white as a fungus. It is to her that the little room belongs. An electric bell rang. The woman touched a switch, and the music was silent. "I suppose I must see who it is," she thought, and set her chair in motion. The chair, like the music, was worked by machinery, and it rolled her to the other side of the room where the bell still rang importunately.
That is the opening of E.M. Forster's short story, The Machine Stops. And I've got a bit of a beef here. The story is called The Machine Stops. Spoiler!
So much suspense could have been created by just adding a question mark to the end of the title. The Machine Stops? I wonder if it does. I better read this. I pulled this story from a list of the 10 best science fiction stories everyone should read, as the title of the article, at interestingliterature.com. It was number 2 behind The Time Machine, which was a little more than a decade old when The Machine Stops was first published in 1909. And this story was prompted by that book to an extent. I think E.M. Forster was reacting to that book when he wrote this. We, of course, covered The Time Machine in great detail on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, but the machine rebrands, and we're talking about this one on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. Our reader is Levi Nunez.
Yes, glad to have him back. You can hear Levi every once in a while in the movies, randomly. He's in a loop group for everything. Oh, every studio picture doing background voices and ADR. His is truly the voice of the people.
It is. And he's also the genius behind the epic music of Loot the Body. Loot the Body has a new collection of songs available on Bandcamp called Music from the Book of the New Sun. And this was originally done for another podcast, Podside Picnic, that's doing a read-along of Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun.
There are 4 tracks: The Shadow of the Torturer, The Claw of the Conciliator, The Sword of the Lictor, and The Citadel of the Autarch.
These are soundscape type instrumental pieces, and they are mind expanding.
You're hearing some of it right now. Does your mind feel expanded? I bet it does. Levi has got an amazing collection of fantasy-themed music at Bandcamp. If I were you, I'd just pick up the whole damn lot and get 25% off when you do it. And then you can make your own machine chamber throb with melodious sounds, as in that opening paragraph that Levi read. You know, the idea that one could just dial up some music to listen to at home. In 1909, that was pretty futuristic.
Yeah.
It was only on Christmas Eve 1906 that Canadian-American inventor Reginald Fessenden used a synchronous rotary spark transmitter for the first radio program broadcast from Massachusetts. Ships at Sea heard a broadcast that included Fessenden playing O Holy Night on the violin and reading a passage from the Bible. Because Loot the Body wasn't available yet, so that's what he had to do.
Yeah.
Loot the Body wasn't available, neither was radio, as we know it, for some time. In the decade when this story was written, in the Edwardian 1900s, cars were just becoming a thing. The typewriter was just coming out. That was a new machine. The Wright brothers had just demonstrated flight in 1903. We had no commercial airlines or anything like that. So it's all the more impressive that this city not only incorporates those technologies, but then leapfrogs past them to imagine the internet and the world of today to a large extent. And we'll get to all that, but I guess first let's talk about this author, E.M. Forster, whom I really only know of from some Merchant Ivory films in the 80s and 90s, like Howard's End. I had no idea this guy wrote science fiction, and I gotta say, great science fiction.
Yeah. Our author was born Edward Morgan Forster in 1879 in London. His father died when he was only 2 years old, and Forster was raised by his mother.
I believe he continued to live with his mother off and on throughout his life until her death in the 40s.
They moved to Hertfordshire soon after his father's death and lived in a place called Rook's Nest. That was his inspiration for Howard's End. When he was older, Forster got a large inheritance from his great aunt, which allowed him to spend a lot of time writing.
It was about 8,000 pounds, which is the equivalent of close to £1 million today, which is quite a lot of money, but it had to be stretched out over a lifetime. So he did continue to take jobs here and there.
In 1904, he traveled to Greece and Italy, exploring classical heritage. He spent some time in Germany to learn the language, and he spent some time teaching the kids of Elizabeth von Arnim. And he says that that was one of the happiest times of his life. His first novel, Where Angels Fear to Tread, was published in 1905. The novel was adapted into a movie in 1991. Mm. In 1906, he fell in love with Saeed Ras Masood, a 17-year-old that he was tutoring in Latin. He was like 27 at the time. Yeah. But Masood just thought they were really good friends. Like, he was an affectionate dude. It wasn't sexual for him, but...
Yeah, I think some confusion happened there.
Yeah, what's going on there. In 1907, Forster published The Longest Journey. In 1908, A Room with a View, adapted in 1985 with Helen Bonner Carter and Daniel Day-Lewis. Now, Howard Zinn was published in 1910. This was also adapted into a movie in 1992 with Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson.
Right.
In the First World War, he was a conscientious objector, but he served in Egypt. It says that it was there he lost his respectability to a wounded soldier in 1917.
He had written most of his novels by that point.
Now, his greatest success was with the novel Passage to India in 1924, about the later days of the British Raj.
There is an adaptation of Passage to India from the director David Lean that came out in 84. I have to admit, it was only in the last few years that I finally got around to seeing Lawrence of Arabia and Bridge on the River Kwai, despite those both being film classics.
Yes.
Both of which made me understand, oh, that's why Alec Guinness resented being known for Star Wars. Because he's great in those movies.
He's really great. Forster was openly gay with his friends, but not publicly.
That bit about losing his respectability, that comes from a somewhat recent article in The Guardian titled E.M. Forster's Work Tailed Off Once He Finally Had Sex. Better that than A Life of Despair. That's the full title. The article reads that after that encounter in 1917, he set about making up for lost time. Quote, I should have been a more famous writer if I had written or rather published more, he later explained, but sex prevented the latter.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
He wrote the novel Maurice about a gay relationship back in 1914, which was inspired by the gay activist Edward Carpenter, with whom he was friends. It wasn't published until after his death. He died in 1970 at the age of 91. Now, this story, The Machine Stops, was first published in the Oxford and Cambridge Review in November of 1909, and then later in his collection, The Eternal Moment and Other Stories in 1928.
There's just a hint of that author offering a thought experiment in the beginning, similar to Le Guin's Omelas. It's the only time we really hear it when the opening line reads, imagine if you can.
Yeah.
And in that paragraph, he also refers to the story as a meditation. So the author's kind of saying, this is a hypothetical.
Sure.
But he quickly drops that and we sort of just get into the guts of it.
Our story begins in this small room. There are no windows, but there is soft light and fresh air. There are sounds that are pleasant, but nothing seems to be making the sound. A lump of a pale woman sits in an armchair at a table. That is all there is in this room, nothing else. The woman is Vashti, and she is getting a call from her son, Kuno. We get some interesting stuff here. We find out that she's connected to thousands of people in her little space, and she cuts off those connections to speak privately with her son. And we also find out that Vashti is going to be giving a lecture to some of these people on music during the Australian period. And I immediately thought, she's live streaming, and her son is going to Skype his mom. And I'm like, wait, when was this story written? Because I didn't know. I just picked it up because it was on the list and I started reading it. I'm like, wow, this is kind of prescient. And it was like, 1908? What?
I had the same. Yeah, I was reading and then I scrolled back up because the publication date was on the top of the story. 1909? I would have expected something like this in the 1950s.
Yeah.
When people are looking at televisions and starting to wonder, oh, what's going to happen? Films were happening around the time this was written, but they were really new.
Yeah.
There was an article about this story on the BBC in May of 2020, when the pandemic was very fresh. The article was by Will Gompertz, and it read, The Machine Stops is not simply prescient. It is a jaw-droppingly, gobsmackingly, breathtakingly accurate literary description of lockdown life in 2020. If it had been written today, it would be excellent. It was written over a century ago. It's astonishing.
Yeah.
I agree. There's some shockingly accurate stuff. I feel like Forster was wowing his audience with this music that's able to emanate from everywhere, you know, because this is a culture that doesn't really have radio yet, which, you know, it's funny when you read about radio at the time, it was this disruptive force where people are like, who's going to pay for music anymore now that you can get it for free over the airwaves? But yeah, there were little details in this that blew me away, like, who is it she called? Her voice was irritable, for she had been interrupted often since the music began. She knew several thousand people. In certain directions, human intercourse had advanced enormously, which you mentioned. But the Zooming or Skyping and the live streaming, that's surprising enough, but that she knew several thousand people thing, that's social media.
Yeah.
And his human intercourse that advanced enormously line seems to be dripping with contempt for that.
Yeah.
You know, is a large number of friends or followers that you are acquainted with virtually better than having a few real solid relationships.
Oh, I know the answer to this. No. It's not.
Yes, we're sitting here sneering at all of this along with the author. Although, you know, I read this story on the machine, got it from the internet. Mm-hmm. And right now we're basically doing what Vashti's about to do, which is transmitting a sort of lecture.
Oh, yeah.
To a few thousand people on this story.
I get the irony.
Yeah, she's basically doing an Australian music podcast in the story, which is crazy.
Then, she is.
Even then, when she isolates in order to talk to her son, that to me feels like the iPhone having the do not disturb mode or focus mode or whatever.
Right, yeah.
You know, this idea of like, we care about you, so we're innovating to protect you from our product.
And she says, be quick, Kuno. Here I am in the dark, wasting my time. The fact that she is kind of short with him and snippy, and she wants to be online dealing with all the people that she knows and not interacting with her son, who's, you know, it's her son, for crying out loud.
They're talking, it's sort of on this tablet-like device, right? It's like a disc, mm-hmm. which I thought was interesting as well. And she also says, what is it? Come on, let's get on with it. Why couldn't you send it to me by pneumatic post? Meaning, you know, why didn't you email me? Although it is pneumatic post, which means messages are flying around through tubes in this reality, which is good in steampunk.
Yeah.
Did you do the drive-through at the bank with the pneumatic tubes when you were a kid?
You bet I did.
Oh, man, I was so excited to do that. You drive up, and my mom would put the deposit slip in that thing, get sucked in over to the window to the person. It was so
neat. She would let me do it occasionally. You know, like, oh, can I do it? Can I put it in? She's like, yeah, sure.
And I was, you know, a kid got his arm stuck in there, and it got ripped off. That's the reason I stopped doing that.
No.
Yeah.
Well, the kid wasn't me, so.
He haunts that bank still.
We got to cover that story. Kuno doesn't beat around the bush, and he tells his mother that he wants her to come visit him. He wants to talk to her in person and not through the machine. Her first response is, why? We can talk right now.
He says, I want to speak to you not through the wearisome machine. And she's a little shocked by that adjective. She says, you mustn't say anything against the machine.
And he says this, you talk as if a god had made the machine. I believe that you pray to it when you are unhappy. Men made it. Do not forget that. Great men, but men. The machine is much, but it is not everything. I see something like you in this plate, but I do not see you. I hear something like you through the telephone, but I do not hear you. That is why I want you to come. Pay me a visit so that we can meet face to face and talk about the hopes that are in my mind.
How many times have we said that exact same thing to each other? The religiosity of this is interesting because it feels like, well, I'm not that way, you know, with this machine that we use.
Sure.
But in some ways, I am, because if the Wi-Fi goes out, there's that feeling of panic, you know? You always have that phone in your hand, almost like rosary beads. You can go to it if you're bored, sad, need some connection.
Yeah.
And when that is suddenly not available to you, you look around. Oh no, I've lost my God. I'm alone and naked in the world.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, this story is about the dependency of on technology and how that might be not a good thing. The airship will take 2 days to get to his place, which we discover through conversation is underground. Everybody on Earth lives underground. The surface is brown and not habitable. Vashti says that the night sky is dreadful and you could see stars. And Kuno says that seeing stars gives him ideas. Like the stars can be connected into images, like they were in the shape of a man with a sword, which I assume he's talking about Orion. And riding in an airship gave him these ideas.
Yeah, I think he came up with Orion all on his own. It wasn't like he read about constellations.
No.
He saw that grouping of stars and go, it kind of looks like a man with a sword on his belt. She says, I don't even know what you're talking about. What's a sword? But it is funny to me because that's sort of the conversation I have anytime somebody's trying to show me constellations.
Oh, yeah.
I can never see it. I'm, you know, connect the dots was not my strong suit growing up.
Oh, wow.
Just always like, yeah, that looks like, I guess it looks like a guy. I don't know. I just see.
It requires a lot of imagination to
it
see
does.
Those things. The Skype system isn't quite like ours. It says here, the machine did not transmit nuances of expression. It only gave a general idea of people, an idea that was good enough for all practical purposes, Vashti thought. The imponderable bloom declared by a discredited philosophy to be the actual essence of intercourse was rightly ignored by the machine, just as the imponderable bloom of the grape was ignored by the manufacturers of artificial fruit. Something good enough had long since been accepted by our race.
Man, once again, I mean, that paragraph in and of itself is a meal. That phrase, the imponderable bloom, is his phrase. And it really is articulating why you need to have firsthand experiences with things. The thing that blew me away about the story, yes, there is a prediction of the technology, but also a pretty accurate prediction of some of these effects. To me, it's the imponderable bloom is the difference between being at a concert and watching it on television. The reason it's imponderable is because there's such an array of sensations going on, you can't directly point to, well, it's the air that makes it different, or it's the people screaming next to me that makes it different. It's all of those things. Or people during the pandemic that couldn't go to school, that imponderable bloom is what the whole thing's about.
Right.
And exactly. If you have to miss those, that's the real tragedy of the pandemic, is folks having to miss going to class and then doing it online instead. It's just not the same.
Now, Kuno confesses he wants to see the stars again like their ancestors did. He wants to visit the surface of the Earth. His mother doesn't think going to the surface is bad, just what's the point? What ideas can one find up on the surface? She also says that he can't survive on the surface without a respirator. She says something that she knows is going to upset him, that going to the surface is contrary to the spirit of the age. And he rebuts, oh, you mean contrary to the machine? And she says, well, kind of. And then he just hangs up on her. She turns the lights back on, and then we get a look at her room.
There were buttons and switches everywhere, buttons to call for food, for music, for clothing. There was the hot bath button, by pressure of which the basin of imitation marble rose out of the floor, filled to the brim with a warm, deodorized liquid. There was the cold bath button. There was the button that produced literature. And there were, of course, the buttons by which she communicated with her friends. The room, though it contained nothing, was in touch with all that she cared for in the world.
When she reconnects with the machine, she's flooded with questions and information that were coming to her when she put it on pause to talk with her son. She gives her opinion on new food, on people's new ideas and their thoughts. It sounds a lot like social media.
And just like social media, as a reader, I'm wondering, how important is it that she does react to all of this? You know, are these pressures she put on herself?
Mm-hmm.
It's that feeling of, I better make a comment on this news story. What am I going to say about it? Nobody cares.
Now, she does her live stream on Australian music. People no longer meet in person for these types of things. Her lecture is only 10 minutes long, but folks love it. She chats with people afterwards. Then she gets ready for bed, which is just a push of the button, and a bed comes out where there wasn't one before, which is too big for her, she thinks. And she put in a request for a smaller bed, but the machine doesn't like variations.
Yeah, individual experiences have been largely erased from the world.
Her nightstand then comes out with her bed, and it has a copy of the Book of the Machine. In it were instructions against every possible contingency. If she was hot or cold or dyspeptic or at a loss for a word, she went to the book and it told her which button to press. The Central Committee published it. And then she does this little kind of prayer. She glanced round the glowing room as if someone might be watching her. Then, half ashamed, half joyful, she murmured, "Oh, machine," and raised the volume to her lips. Thrice she kissed it. Thrice inclined her head, thrice she felt the delirium of acquiescence. Her life is easy and simple.
She made the room dark and slept. She awoke and made the room light. She ate and exchanged ideas with her friends and listened to music and attended lectures. She made the room dark and slept. Above her, beneath her, and around her, the machine hummed eternally. She did not notice the noise, for she had been born with it in her ears. The earth carrying her hummed as it sped through silence, turning her now to the invisible sun, now to the invisible stars. She awoke and made the room light.
Sebastian tries to call her son again, but he won't talk to her until she agrees to come visit him. She relents and decides that she's going to visit him. She must push a button that she never presses, and the wall will open into a tube, and a car will come, and it'll take her to the airship station. But then she has this thought. She had studied the civilization that had immediately preceded her own, the civilization that had mistaken the functions of the system and had used it for bringing people to things instead of bringing things to people. Those funny old days when men went for change of air instead of changing the air in their rooms. And I obviously think of today, how we have so much stuff delivered to us as opposed to the old days.
And the fact that those retailers have achieved such dominance means that this homogenous thing has happened as well, in that people all over the world start buying the same stuff. You think that the internet, I mean, as the internet was dreamed of and introduced to us in the 90s, it was this ultimate individualizer where you could find the people who were like you and you could live these unique experiences. And as it goes on, it becomes more consolidated. And now it's a machine that makes things the same in a lot of respects.
Now, she doesn't want to leave. she really doesn't want to go. So she calls Kuno and says that she can't travel. She's unwell. She wants him to come to her, but he says he can't. Something tremendous may happen. Something he won't tell her through the machine.
The excuse of not being well gets met by the machine immediately. Two, it says an enormous apparatus fell onto her out of the ceiling. A thermometer was automatically laid upon her heart. She lay powerless. Cool pads soothed her forehead. Vashti drank the medicine that the doctor projected into her mouth. Gross. And the machinery retired into the ceiling.
She goes back to her life, thinking about him as a child, how after his birth, he was taken to the public nurseries.
Parents, comma, duties of, said the book of the machine, cease at the moment of birth. So all of the kids are raised by the machine, which makes this world even more homogenous. And Kuno was sent to live on the other side of the earth, but that doesn't even matter because everything's the same everywhere.
Yeah. Now, she always thought Kuno was special, even of all of her children. So she's got a lot of children, I guess. And something about what he said, something tremendous might happen. It's got her curious. So she pushes the button. And she gets in the car and she goes.
The whole idea of the machine raising everybody, I do think also contributes to it makes sense that they would begin to worship it in a way. Your parents hold this mythic position.
Sure.
So much so that there's some kind of parental reconciliation of some sort in most stories. So, of course, if you're completely raised by this machine, you're going to adopt that kind of reverence. Speaking of religion, her name Vashti, that's a name from the Book of Esther. And basically, Vashti's husband, the king, he orders her to show up and display her beauty while he's drunk at a banquet with his court and his advisors, and she refuses to do it. Interpretations being that he wanted her in there naked, dancing around, so he could show her off. She says, I'm not going to do that for you. The king, on the advice of his advisors, banishes or maybe executes her, I'm not sure, and then marries the much more obedient Esther says, send out the message that, you know, we won't take these willful wives. Men have to dominate their ladies in the household. I think definitely her unwillingness to travel, her weirdness about people seeing her or touching her, probably from Forster is why she was named Vashti. Although that character in the Bible, I'm kind of on her side. I think she's a cool feminist character. Kuno, I don't know if there's a literary source of that name, but the name in its meaning means clan or family. So clearly those are the things that Kuno is interested in, connection.
Now everything in the car and in the airship look just like her room. You know, the chair is the same type of chair. Everything is made like that on purpose. Everything's the same. And that's why people don't really travel anymore. Why go to Peking if everything in Peking looks like everything at your house? So the airship is a relic from a former age, it says. It was kept up because it was easier to maintain than it was to make something new, especially since fewer people use them these days.
The paragraph about everywhere being the same is another interesting prediction in the story. The Amazon deliveries, like we talked, like I just mentioned, make things a little homogenous. But that's why you'll find somebody pining for the days of porno theaters in Times Square or something. Do they really like the filth? Or does it have more to do with the fact that the forces that moved in just made New York like everywhere else? You know what I mean?
Wait, who's pining for the porno theaters?
Talk to any New Yorker who lived there in the 70s, whether they liked it at the time or not. They'll go, oh, the good old days. Triple X, you know, you were afraid someone would murder you. Every time you went downstairs, the good old days. Now it's Disney stores and M&M shops.
That's, well, I mean, and that's all these chains. You know, you get your Starbucks, your McDonald's, all these places look the same, no matter where in the world they are.
I was happy the last time I visited you that we were going up north to see you instead of going to London, because London's got all kinds of great stuff, but to an extent, it doesn't feel that different from Chicago or New York because of all the chain stores and things that I recognize from my own world.
Yeah. We still have them here, though. Up in Keighley, we got Subway, we got McDonald's, we got Burger King, we got all that. And they look the same. They're not different.
And some of them I'm happy about. And then every time I see a Subway, I go, oh, what if somebody made me go in there and eat? I always have that thought.
Vashti doesn't like this direct experience of traveling. The airship smells differently. Not bad, just different. And she sees other passengers in person, which she doesn't like. They all have their own rooms, very similar to their home rooms, so they don't have to see much of each other. But Vashti, she still doesn't like it.
She had to walk to it from the lift, had to submit to glances from the other passengers. I thought this was really interesting. The man in front dropped his book. No great matter, but it disquieted them all. In the rooms, if the book was dropped, the floor raised it mechanically. But the gangway to the airship was not so prepared, and the sacred volume lay motionless. They stopped. The thing was unforeseen, and the man, instead of picking up his property, felt the muscles of his arm to see how they had failed him. It's this, like, people are so estranged from their own bodies.
Yeah.
And from using them. And in that respect, this is a lot like Wall-E or Idiocracy. I remember I had a cracked magazine in the 80s where it was projecting the future and it was like everybody was just puffy bits of flesh. The Walkman had done this to everybody because that was sort of new technology at the time.
The Walkman.
But it was like the guy was listening to his Walkman all day, and then when he needed to go to his car in the garage, he had a moped that would get him from his bedroom to the garage. And it made me laugh because it really felt like, well, maybe we are headed there.
Well, I hope not. Jeez.
I hope not.
There is a female attendant that helps them, but Vashti hates her being there, and she's afraid of this alien experience. And then she quietly prays to herself, oh, machine. It's night, and she can see out the window the coast of Sumatra, edged by phosphorescent waves and lighthouses. People get annoyed that it's dark because they're not used to that. Their light is controlled by them most of the time, and the attendant has to turn on the lights for them. The ship was designed for people who wanted to look out, but none of these people want that. In her cabin, Vashti is annoyed that there's a slight opening in the blind of one of the windows, and she could see a star outside, and it makes her uneasy. Eventually, when the sun comes up, that's odd to her too, and the strange colored light of it. She thinks about the time before when people used to fly airplanes around the world, but that had been made illegal by the Committee of the Machine, punishable with homelessness.
Of homelessness, more will be said later, says here.
So she rings the attendant, who tries to help her. As Vashti stands up, the ship movement causes her to lose her balance, and the attendant catches her. But Vashti is furious that she would dare touch her. People never touch one another. The custom had become obsolete owing to the machine.
Ugh.
So in an effort to calm Vashti, the attendant shows her out the window some of the mountains. They used to be called the Himalayas.
She says they were once called the roof of the world, those mountains. You must remember that. Before the dawn of civilization, they seemed to be an impenetrable wall that touched the stars. It was supposed that no one but the gods could exist above their summits. How we have advanced, thanks to the machine.
And Vashti chimes right back, thanks to the machine. And that other people in the ship, they could overhear it and say, thanks to the machine. So it's very crazy cult-like.
Yeah.
So Vashti asks what all that white stuff is on the mountains. But the attendant says she's forgotten what it's called. So they forgot snow. They don't even know what it is.
Yeah.
She's not impressed by it. Vashti says, cover the window, please. These mountains give me no ideas.
The day dragged wearily forward. The passengers sat each in his cabin, avoiding one another with an almost physical repulsion and longing to be once more under the surface of the earth. There were 8 or 10 of them, mostly young males, sent out from the public nurseries to inhabit the rooms of those who had died in various parts of the earth. The man who had dropped his book was on the homeward journey. He had been sent to Sumatra for the purpose of propagating the race. Vashti alone was traveling by her private will. At midday, she took a second glance at the earth. The airship was crossing another range of mountains, but she could see little, owing to clouds. Masses of black rock hovered below her and merged indistinctly into gray. Their shapes were fantastic. One of them resembled a prostrate man. No ideas here, murmured Vashti, and hid the Caucasus behind a metal blind. In the evening, she looked again. They were crossing a golden sea in which lay many small islands and one peninsula. She repeated, no ideas here, and hid Greece behind a metal blind.
Nothing but ideas, it seems like, in this geography, but she's rejecting it. And I think that's a good place to stop, also because Forrester himself stopped here.
Yes.
That's the first chapter, and we're going to get into the second next time.
Yeah, this story is amazing. I'm just blown away by it.
When I was a teenager, I would have probably been very focused on this guy who was being set to propagate the race. What's that job like? Maybe this future is not so bad. It's an amazing story, and the conclusion is going to be a good one in the next episode. But a lot to think about. I hope folks will go pick this one up or check our link in the show notes.
Yeah,
and read it for yourself, because I think you're really going to enjoy it.
It's really well written and it flows. It's easy to get into.
It's definitely not inaccessible as our track names like The Shadow of the Torturer or The Claw of the Conciliator or The Sword of the Lictor or The Citadel of the Autark. In order to understand what those damn things are all about, you're going to have to pick up the Loot the Body collection of songs called Music from the Book of the New Sun. And that is by our reader today, Levi Nunez. Thank you, Levi, for reading on the show.
Levi will continue with us next week. And you can be sure you'll hear more about Loot the Body, because I love it. I can't stop talking about it. And I can't stop talking about our patrons.
I can't stop talking about them either, and I'm going to do some of that right now. I want to thank our patron, Roman Draws.
I'd like to thank Brian Grubner.
Hey, Brian. Brian is the mind behind the Gothsicles.
All right.
Good dude. I'd like to thank Jeff Chapin.
I'd like to thank Paul Zimmerman.
I'd like to thank Omar Amador.
Hey, David. Thank you.
Hey, Blacksmith. Thank you.
Stitch. Thank you.
Stitch, that's Stitch with a Y. Sekhmet, thank you so much.
I want to thank somebody with a great name, Chris.
I want to thank another great Chris, Christopher Dean. Two great names, Chris and Dean.
I'd like to thank Michael Angarone.
Scott Melton. Hey, how you doing, Scott? Thank you.
Joshua Perlstein. Thank you.
And finally, James Gority. Thank you so much. So glad to have you guys patronizing the show, patronizing us, as so many have done. We're going to be back with the second half of this awesome story next week. That's all we've got for this week on The Machine Stops. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackett. You've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.